Mozart had been carefully examining an olive tree.
"I know that,"
Mokhtar said, attempting to recover.
"But the vegetation around the coffee plants affects their health."
He had made this up on the spot, and only later discovered that it was true. Yusuf nodded respectfully, and they walked on.
"Here are the coffee plants," Yusuf said.
Now Mokhtar touched the leaves and saw a constellation of red and green cherries under the leaf cluster. The hillside was covered by an undulating grid of bright green Caffea arabica plants, thriving on what looked to be an arid mountainside. There was the smell of jasmine, the faint hushing of the breeze passing through the dense foliage.
"So, what do you think?" Yusuf asked.
"Good,"
Mokhtar said. He didn't know what Yusuf was looking for. They walked on and soon were joined by a growing throng of farmers and pickers who asked a series of questions.
"The leaves are being eaten by borrowworm. What should we do?"
"What about pesticides? What do you think of the soil here? What's this white stuff ringing the trunk of this one?"
Mokhtar had no idea. He was no agronomist. This was the first coffee farm he'd ever been to. Not that he could tell anyone this, but Luf was an agronomist. And Luf stepped in.
"That's the sodium," he said about the white rings. "This plant is getting too much salt."
He began answering the questions, touching the leaves, squatting down, inspecting the soil. He had answers to all their queries, and Mokhtar activated his tenderloin memorization brain, processing all that Luf said, ready to regurgitate it later. Luf went into the merits of pruning, explaining that every tree was like a family, each bough a child, and that a plant could only support so many healthy boughs, that any boughs that weren't viable needed to be pruned. He pointed out the different varietals, names of which most of the farmers and pickers didn't know.
"This is a tufahi," he said. "This is dawairi, this is udeni."
The farmers had simply been growing coffee, the generalized coffee of the second wave. Yusuf was aware that there was something out there in the wider world, something changing, some new attention being paid to regions and varietals, but his co-op didn't have enough information or access. They didn't know which varietal was which thrived where, how best to pick and process cherries of these varying kinds, and, most of all, who would pay for it. Mokhtar was careful. He had a sense that somewhere down the line he could help with the supply chain, and he hoped that he might be able to connect these farmers with high-end buyers in the U.S. and Europe and Japan. But he couldn't say any of that now. His grandfather had drilled that into him.
"Don't make promises unless you're sure you can deliver. And don't make them until you have the funds to deliver."
For the time being, then, Mokhtar walked with Yusuf and Luf. And he listened. He listened to Luf talk about how best to pick the cherries and when to pick them. He observed Luf's way of speaking, his mannerisms, and tucked them away for future use. And he tried to keep up as Yusuf and the older and even elderly growers and pickers moved up and down the terraces like rabbits. Mokhtar had to be pulled back from cliffs and caught after slipping on steps. The air was thin and he had to catch his breath. His unsteadiness entertained the local men.
"Who's that?"
Mokhtar asked. Mokhtar noticed the one man sitting alone under a tall and extraordinarily healthy coffee tree.
"That's Malik," Yusuf said. "Our best farmer."
He sat cross-legged in the shade, looking supremely content.
"He does that a lot," Yusuf said. "He's always out here. When he's not picking, he's sitting out here among the trees."
Malik wore a gray pillbox-shaped hat called a kufi, adorned with complex embroidery. Mokhtar was intrigued by the man's aura and attire, and took a few pictures, noticing that the man had placed his day's pickings on a towel by his feet. He had about 500 cherries there, all ruby red.
"That's why he's our best farmer,"
Yusuf said. Apparently Malik did most of the picking himself, with the help of his wife and a few family members. For them, it was not a job or hobby or something delegated to careless hourly workers. It was a calling, something they enjoyed and in which they took a spiritual kind of pride. In the cooperative, Malik owned perhaps 400 coffee plants, which stood next to those owned by another farmer.
All of the farmers picked their own coffee, which was then mixed together in a mass of cherries, red and green, ripe and rotten. These were then sold to a broker, who usually exploited the financial disadvantage of the farmers. There was no separation of lots or varietals. It was all one heap, sold for whatever price the brokers offered. Mokhtar approached Malik as he sat under his tree. The man did not stand up or act in any way deferential. In fact, he didn't seem the least bit surprised or excited to meet this man from Sana'a and America. But when Mokhtar asked if he could take a sample of his cherries back to Sana'a, Malik respectfully agreed.
"We can give you a big bag later on," Yusuf said.
"I want these," Mokhtar said. "I want this man's cherries, and I want them separate from all others." For lunch, Yusuf brought them to his home. Somehow he'd won the lottery conducted when Mokhtar first arrived. Yusuf's house was a traditional Yemeni rural dwelling. The first floor was open and dark, intended for livestock. The second floor, and every floor above, was dedicated to a branch of the family. Each of the home's seven floors was called a house, and each was given to a different family, or families, everyone related. In Yusuf's home, there were four generations. Mokhtar and Luf were treated to a feast, though one belying the relative poverty of the village. The chicken was lean and gamey. The rice was plentiful, and there was bread, and sahakwa, a salsa-like dish made from the hot peppers the region was known for. With the meal, served with great ceremony, Mokhtar and Luf were given coffee, which Yusuf noted was made from the coffee trees they'd just walked among. But it wasn't coffee, not the kind of coffee consumed anywhere else in the world. This was a beverage made from the dried husk of the coffee cherry. It was what Mokhtar and most non-Yemenis called kishr, a sweet kind of tea, caramel-colored but with a certain sweetness, a ghost of the cherry in its center. It was delicious, but it wasn't coffee. Mokhtar didn't know how to tell Yusuf this and knew it didn't bode well. If the president of the cooperative didn't know the difference between coffee and tea, then there were more problems than he'd anticipated. After lunch, they set for Kat and were joined by dozens of men, most of them farmers, many of them other villagers who were interested in the visiting Yemeni American and his Sana'a friend. Everyone was intrigued by Mokhtar. All but one man. Mokhtar had seen him here and there throughout the day. He was a stout man wearing the coat of a former soldier and what looked like a Russian hat, with furry ear flaps folded upward. He had an AK-47 slung over his shoulder and two grenades fastened to his chest. Mokhtar had caught his skeptical eyes and asked Yusuf about him.
"That's the general," Yusuf said. "Don't mind him. Hard to please."
He had been a general in the Yemeni army, and upon retiring, had bought land in the Hema Valley, where he planted both kat and coffee. He was one of the largest landowners in the region. The general glared at Mokhtar throughout the meal. Luf wouldn't chew kat. He never did. Mokhtar thought it best to indulge, so as not to offend their hosts, but Luf wouldn't budge. And besides, this was a different style of kat enjoyment. In the city, the kat would be pruned neatly, prepared and presented carefully. Here it was dumped in the middle of the floor like kindling. But Mokhtar took leaves and filled his cheek, and they all talked idly until the kat had kicked in. A wave of mild euphoria spread through the room, and Mokhtar chose the moment to present them with the past and the future. He told the men about the birth of coffee, that it was first cultivated here, in Yemen, that it was a central part of the country's history, their birthright. Most of the men seemed surprised by this. Had they known this? He wasn't sure. He went on, explaining that the Dutch had stolen the seedlings, had planted them in Java, and had given them to France, and the French had planted them in Martinique, and that the Portuguese had smuggled them from the French, had planted them in Brazil, and that now there was a $70 billion market for coffee. That everyone seemed to be making money from the bean. Everyone but the Yemenis, who had started the whole business in the first place. Maybe it was the kat, but he had their attention. Even the general was listening, albeit with a look askance. Most of their beans were going to Saudi Arabia, Mokhtar explained. The farmers were selling them for next to nothing, and that needed to change. But first, They had to improve their practices. They should harvest cherries only once they were red, and here he showed them his ring, with the carnelian stone inset. And then you need to dry the cherries on above-ground beds so air can circulate and they dry evenly. Then you need to store them properly, in cool and dry rooms, so they don't ferment or accumulate mold. Right now, he explained, you're picking too soon, and the green and yellow and red cherries are being mixed together and dried improperly and shipped recklessly and sorted carelessly, if at all. The roasting was a disaster in Saudi, he said, so all along the chain, the plants were being disrespected, the beans abused. He went on, telling them about the monk of Mocha, about how they needed to reclaim their heritage, and how if they improved their process, if they picked better, dried better, stored and shipped better, the prices might be higher, their wages might be higher.
"Will you help us?" a man asked.
And Mokhtar caught the tiniest hint of expectation in the general's eye.
"Me?"
Mokhtar thought. "Not yet, at least." He hedged. Though he wanted to, he couldn't tell them he was looking at all of this not just as a consultant, not just as some vague representative of the CQI or USAID, but as a potential buyer, a potential exporter. After Kat, he and Luf were asked to sign the village registry. Every visitor for centuries had signed it, an enormous book with yellowed pages. Mokhtar signed his name, and under it, he wrote, "With your sweat and blood and hard work, your coffee will be the best in the world." It seemed like the right thing to say. On the drive back, Yusuf was visibly excited.
"So, you can help us get better prices?"
"I don't know," Mokhtar said. "But if we improve our processes, we can get a higher rate."
"I'm not sure," Mokhtar said.
"Can you improve?"
They got back to Sana'a late. The city was quiet, and Mokhtar let himself into Mohammed and Kenza's house and put his coffee samples under a chair in the corner, unspooled his bedroll, and lay down. "I can't do this," he thought. "No chance." Somewhere during the long drive home, winding their way through hundreds of miles of two-lane roads, passing countless armed strangers, thinking at any moment that their truck would be stopped again at a checkpoint, Mokhtar's doubts overtook him. This was the first trip, and he'd already faced a hillside of vengeful tribesmen. He'd bluffed his way through one farm visit, but this was over his head. It was madness. And there were the loan sharks. He was going to go head-to-head with loan sharks. Loan sharks he knew nothing about. His grandfather was from a powerful tribe, but was Mokhtar ready to cut a bunch of bloodthirsty moneylenders out of the process? Clearly their scruples were questionable. They were subjugating these farmers and had no respect for the quality of the coffee they were selling. What would happen if Mokhtar from San Francisco came in and cut them out of the loop? And these farms were disastrous. Some of those beans had been stored for 5 years. The farmers were sitting on them like imperishable currency, as if the beans never aged. And the thing with the tea, did they know the difference between tea from the husk and coffee from the bean? And could he really improve harvesting practices such that the coffee was actually worth significantly more? And who knew if it was any good in the first place? That is, even if they picked it correctly and dried it correctly and processed it correctly and did everything else correctly, who could predict if the coffee was actually any good? The coffee made from these beans might be terrible, and that would be a fact that no amount of supply chain adjustments could remedy. And again, he knew nothing. He'd been studying coffee for months and learning from the best, from Blue Bottle and Willem Boot, and that had given him some knowledge about cupping and roasting, but he didn't know anything about growing these plants, or harvesting, or sorting. He knew nothing about the actual plant growing in the actual world. Luf had run circles around him. Nope, he thought. He was a clown. He had a company name and a logo, but he didn't know what he was doing. He borrowed money from Omar, and now it would all be wasted. He could and should go home. He could go to college, study something. He'd lived long enough as a corner cutter. With this, he couldn't play fake it till you make it. Chapter 22. Point of Departure.
Then again, It had worked before.
The roundabout became his point of departure. Almost every day for the next 3 months, he went down to the Panasonic roundabout and got into a different truck, every time venturing out to a different region, determined to visit every one of the 32 coffee-producing areas of Yemen. Some were like Hema, hard-working and reasonably advanced, with farmers he knew that he could work with. Other visits were disheartening. One time, he drove 7 hours to find that the region was home to only a handful of coffee plants, fewer than 20. Some farmers he simply didn't trust. And the skepticism was mutual. In most of the places he visited, the farmers treated his arrival with polite suspicion. They'd been visited by NGOs more or less continually for decades, and by USAID more regularly after 9/11. Sometimes progress was made, sometimes not. Occasionally a water catcher was built. Other times that or any other project was begun, but not finished. The intentions of these aid workers and organizers were fine, sometimes unassailable, but the follow-through was inconsistent. This was the backdrop of Mokhtar's arrival. He would come, well-dressed and speaking his classical Arabic, with his American passport, and though they wanted to believe he had answers, insight, and, most important, some way to get their beans to market for a higher price, they were reluctant to believe. Still, customs of hospitality dictated that he be treated well, so they would show him their terraces, they would feed him a midday meal, in the afternoon chew khat, and occasionally put him up for a night. Did they expect to see him again? Not entirely. Did they expect him to change their lives? No. He knew he could improve their cultivation methods. He knew that by merely ensuring that their pickers chose only the cherries that were ripe, the color of the carnelian stone, their quality would rise dramatically. That pruning would increase the production of the plants. If they dried their cherries on raised drying beds, the quality would rise yet more. If they bagged their beans within plastic, not burlap, they would hold in moisture and improve the taste yet again. These were basic things that they could do on the farming side of it. He knew that if he got hold of a better picked and better processed class of cherries, he could process them more carefully than had been customary, and then, once they were beans, he could sort them far more carefully than had been done in 100 years. He was sure his impact could be real. The challenge was staying alive until the next harvest. In his travels, this would prove difficult. In the first week, he came down with malaria. He was in Bura, in far western Yemen, and he woke up with yellow eyes. He'd gotten it either in Bura or Hema, but here it was, and he couldn't move. He had the shakes. His limbs felt withered and weak. His Bura hosts gave him pills, but he was sure he would die. They brought him to a local hospital, where he spent 2 feverish nights. After recuperating in Sana'a, he went out again, and this time, in Beni Ismail, he was overtaken by a maniacal kind of diarrhea. He spent 2 days circling the shithole, there were no toilets in the village, feeling sure that the next thing to leave his rectum would be his liver. A few weeks later, he was visited by what he and everyone assumed was a tapeworm. He ate all day and all night and couldn't gain weight. Someone said it was his body correcting for the loss of weight incurred during his bouts of malaria and diarrhea. He ate still more, and somehow got even thinner. "You can live with it," one friend said. "Coexist." "Try kerosene," said another friend. Apparently, this had been a long-standing practice, the drinking of kerosene to kill the parasite. Mokhtar decided to wait it out, and after another week his metabolism returned to normal. He had no idea if the tapeworm had exited on its own accord or if he'd had one in the first place. He had a few weeks to enjoy the functioning of his digestive system before he knew the once-in-a-lifetime pain of a gallstone. He spent another night in the hospital for that and left a withered man. He stayed in Yemen 3 months and was sick every 4 or 5 days. He'd been told to be careful with the drinking water, with fruit, with anything that might harbor bacteria, that he was an American and unaccustomed to whatever organisms lived in and were tolerated by Yemenis. And though he knew he should refuse certain foods in certain villages, or most foods, all uncooked foods, all water, all juices, all fruit, in all villages, he couldn't. He was a guest, And he was a guest needing to be respectful, needing to emphasize his own Yemeni heritage, and not underline his foreignness or preciousness. So he ate whatever was put in front of him, and hoped for the best. He got diarrhea too many times to count or care anymore. It was, in the end, a small price to pay, as he benefited from the Yemeni's legendary generosity. He continued to go out. Back in the car, over the rutted roads and through the narrow mountain passes and into new villages, where each time he was greeted by men singing traditional zamus, followed by the lottery to determine who would have the honor of hosting him. For lunch and cot, always they would arrange mountains of pillows and blankets at the head of the room, propping up Mokhtar like a Mongolian warlord. There was always cold soda. Upon Mokhtar's arrival, the village sent its children miles on foot to get it. And after the tour of the terraces and after lunch and cot, there were gifts. Always gifts. If the region was known for mangoes, Mokhtar would leave with more mangoes than he could possibly eat. If honey was made there, he'd leave with enough to fill a tub. And of course, each time he left with coffee cherries, a sample of that village's best, and he'd return to Sana'a to put the samples in a corner of Muhammad and Kenza's living room, and he'd go back to sleep. He went to Beit Aliyah, 2 hours from Sana'a and over 2,000 meters above sea level. Blessed by a plentiful aquifer, its farmers cultivated 30,000 trees. He went to Beni Matar, about 2 hours from Sana'a and 1,800 meters above sea level. In Beni Ismail, he saw the most prized and expensive of all Yemeni coffee. The beans were small and almost circular, heavily dependent on rainfall. The local cooperative was amiable and organized, but they weren't sure how much coffee they produced. In a given harvest, they said, they filled 2 trucks a week for about 8 weeks. Any more detailed measurements, they hadn't done. In El Udein, he saw the most visually beautiful beans in all of Yemen. But the trips were not universally successful. In fact, most were not. One day he drove 7 hours to Hedja, which his research said was a coffee-growing region. When he arrived, he found no coffee plants. A local farmer walking on the dusty road was astonished that Mokhtar had come so far for no reason. "My grandfather's grandfather grew coffee," he said. "You're about 100 years too late." Every time Mokhtar returned to Sana'a, Muhammad and Kenza would note the arrival of another bag, and would note that their living room seemed to be shrinking. But they said nothing to Mokhtar, assuming that what he had told them, that he was writing a report on coffee in Yemen, was the unalloyed truth. After a while, though, he couldn't deceive them anymore. "I'm starting a business," he told them.
"Why didn't you tell us?"
they asked. The answer was complicated, he said. Hamoud had insisted he keep his plans close to the vest. But then there was the matter of how Yemenis saw the domestic coffee business. It wasn't taken seriously. Saying you were in the coffee business was like saying you sold lollipops. No one made a living selling coffee.
"But this can work," he told them.
He told them where he'd been and showed them his photos. They were awed. They'd never seen those parts of Yemen. They'd been to Ibb, sure, but not Hema, not Bora, not Hajja, not Beni Amad.
"Why didn't you take us with you?" they said.
Sometimes he took their son, Nuruddin. At 18, he was the oldest of their 6 children still living at home. He was nearly out of school and without prospects. Thinking about college in America, he'd applied for a visa at the U.S. Embassy and had been turned down in a comically dismissive way. "Who's sponsoring you?" he was asked.
"My brother, Akram," he said. "He works as a janitor at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco."
"San Francisco? That's the most expensive city in the world," the agent said, and rejected the application. After that, Nuruddin applied for and received a visa to live and work in South Korea. He flew to Seoul, but when he landed, they wouldn't accept him. He had all his paperwork in order, but they turned him around and put him back on a plane. He flew to Malaysia instead, a country historically hospitable to Yemenis, and worked for a time in a restaurant where he was underpaid and abused. Now, Mokhtar needed help. He needed someone to come with him to provinces, to help catalog the samples and keep track of the farmers and harvests. Nuruddin became Mokhtar's first employee. with the matter of a proper salary, of course, deferred. Mokhtar continued to go into tribal areas, hours or days from Sana'a, and every time he packed his dagger and a Sig Sauer pistol. His driver had a semi-automatic rifle. When he was in more troubled or unknown districts, he brought along another man who carried an AK-47 and a grenade. None of this was unusual. There were 25 million people in Yemen, and at least 13 million guns. After the United States, it was, per capita, the world's most armed nation. Men wore AKs walking down the street. They brought them to weddings. When Mokhtar was young, Hamoud had given him a pistol, a Colt 45, and Mokhtar still had it. Eventually, he'd bought an old AK-47 and occasionally borrowed Hamoud's 1983 Krinkov. He liked to have them in the truck in case they got caught in a tribal dispute, or if someone tried to get at the cash Mokhtar strapped under his belt, or in case they needed gasoline. Rumor had it that those supporting the ousted Saleh bombed the petroleum pipelines. He wanted to sabotage the infrastructure to convince the Yemeni people that things were better when he was in charge. And so gas sometimes grew scarce, prices skyrocketed, and gas lines grew long. When the lines were long, tempers went hot. Someone tried to cut the line, guns were drawn, shots were fired in the air. Mokhtar got so used to being out in the provinces, returning to Sana'a dusty and unwashed, unshaven and dressed in a tribal way, that he forgot, momentarily, to which world he belonged. Once a week, he'd be in the capital, and he'd go to the Coffee Corner Cafe, an upscale place frequented by wealthy and worldly Yemenis, and some Westerners, and there he'd use the Wi-Fi and write up his reports. One morning, he walked in, unshowered and ill-slept, and he sat near a pair of young women wearing expensive shoes and bright hijabs, their makeup sophisticated and subtle. One of the two pulled out a laptop and began watching the Vampire Diaries without headphones. The whole cafe could hear the show, its wailing and screaming. The two young women didn't care. Soon, though, their attention focused on Mokhtar.
"Look at him," one of the women said. "He's so barbaric and backward."
It took Mokhtar a second to believe she was talking about him. She spoke in English, thinking Mokhtar was a peasant who had somehow wandered into this sophisticated urban cafe. He was wearing his dagger and carrying his pistol, and between that and his disheveled state, he understood that she took him for a tribesman from Yemen's northern hinterlands, who were seen as rough and violent and were often derided by city dwellers. The Houthis adhered to a branch of Shia Islam called Zaydism, which accounted for about 35% of the Muslims in Yemen. Before 1962, the Zaydists had controlled northern Yemen for 1,000 years, and the Houthis frequently clashed with their neighbors over territory, with the Saudis to the north and the Yemeni government to the south. In Sana'a, they were considered a nuisance, uncivilized hillbillies bent on wreaking havoc.
"He's the problem," the woman continued. "Men like that are holding the whole country back."
Mokhtar had work to do, and he was tired. But the orator in him was awake and ready.
"Excuse me, ma'am," he said in English. "You're the problem."
The woman's mouth dropped open. She looked at Mokhtar like he was an animal that had somehow learned to speak.
"You're degrading me," he continued, "while watching your adolescent show without headphones?"
The women watched his mouth, as if struggling to discern whether or not he was being dubbed. They couldn't figure out how these words, in American English, were coming out of the mouth of this savage.
"You need to respect me," Mokhtar said. "And you need to respect this space and the people here and not make assumptions based on how I look. And actually, I think you should leave."
And they did. Looking tribal had its advantages. The next time Mokhtar was in Hema to talk with Yusuf and Malik about drying beds and the next harvest, he woke to a cracking of gunfire in the valley. He packed his AK and followed the sound to a valley where he found a group of men conducting a target shooting contest. The general was among them. The general noted Mokhtar's AK slung over his shoulder.
"You know how to use that?"
he asked skeptically.
"I do," Mokhtar said.
The men were aiming at a small white rock resting on the ridge about 70 yards away. No one had hit it.
Your turn,
the general said. Rafik and Rakan had taught Mokhtar to shoot 22s, handguns, and AKs at Five Dogs Range in Bakersfield, just down the road from Richgrove, and Rafik had educated him about the ammunition used by different firearms and the relative accuracy of each. The men shooting that morning were all using modern AKs, which were powerful and efficient, but less accurate than the AK Mokhtar carried, a pre-1974 model. For target shooting, it was the superior tool. Mokhtar stepped up, aimed, exhaled, and shot. The rock flew off the ridge. He stepped back, accepted the congratulations of the men, and saw something like respect in the face of the general. Knowing he probably couldn't make the shot again, and knowing the value of a well-executed mic drop, Mokhtar shouldered his gun and left. Chapter 23 Out of Sana'a. Mokhtar checked the planes leaving Sana'a and found one going through Qatar. Mokhtar had to get back to the United States. He needed to test the samples he'd collected. He planned to bring 21 lots home and visit family and see about raising a few $100,000 so he could come back and actually buy the coffee, if any, that scored well. He spent 5 days frantically finishing collecting his samples from up and down central and northern Yemen. This was during Ramadan and during the Houthi takeover of the city of Amran, the last northern defense before they could capture Sana'a. Mokhtar was up till 4 a.m. every night milling his samples and going to sleep with coffee dust on his head. Finally, the day before the flight, he packed his clothes. He packed the samples he had at the apartment. Half of his beans were in Ibe. He was storing some with Ubeishi. But they would have to wait. Damn this country, he thought. If this were Amsterdam, he could just FedEx a box tonight, any night. He could leave and call Samir and ask Samir to send them, or Mohammed, or anyone. But in Yemen, anything you wanted to get out of the country in any timely way, you had to take yourself. He bought 5 suitcases and started filling them with 22 samples from 21 farms, every coffee from every region that had any to offer. What else? He had to get honey. His parents wanted Yemeni honey. They also wanted Yemeni almonds and raisins, so he made sure to go to the old quarter of Sana'a. He called his cousin Nuruddin and asked him to help. Nuruddin was awake. Everyone was awake. It was Ramadan, and together they hired a taxi and spent the small hours rushing around the city gathering everything Mokhtar needed. 12 gifts for everyone he could think of back in California. Postcards, frankincense, aloes, prayer beads, silver rings with carnelian stone settings, handmade Kashmiri shawls. When Mokhtar's extended family learned he was flying back to the U.S., a cousin asked him to look after their 6-year-old daughter, Dina, who was flying on the same plane to California. Later, Mokhtar would have a hard time explaining how an arrangement like this was made so casually. The transport of a cousin's daughter, a girl he'd never met, across continents and seas. But getting in and out of Yemen was so difficult, and it was rare when someone like Mokhtar was leaving and could escort a girl like Dina, who was going to see her family in Modesto. So while Dina packed, Mokhtar and Nuruddin continued racing around the sleepless city, feeling very much alive and laughing about it all as the sun was coming up. Then they turned a corner onto one of Sana'a's busiest thoroughfares and drove directly into an active firefight. Machine gun fire cracked open the morning. Mokhtar looked up to see the ends of AKs peeking out over the rooftops of buildings on opposite sides of the street. Their driver should have backtracked quickly, but he hadn't moved.
"Reverse! Reverse!" Mokhtar yelled. "There's no reverse!" the driver yelled. "Get out and push!"
Mokhtar and Nuruddin got out and pushed the taxi backward. They laughed. They couldn't help it.
"Been nice knowing you," Mokhtar said. He figured the odds of survival were about 60-40.
As they pushed the taxi, Mokhtar noticed a propane tank attached to the trunk. This was common in Yemen, given the gasoline shortages. Drivers rigged their engines to run on propane. Mokhtar and Nuri laughed harder. They were pushing a taxi with an exposed propane tank while machine gun fire rattled over their heads. They couldn't run away. All their coffee was in the taxi. An hour later, Mokhtar was at the airport, sitting in the waiting area, thinking about all this, the time an hour earlier when he almost died. He looked over and remembered that he had a 6-year-old girl with him, and that this girl hadn't spoken to him yet. Her mother had kissed her forehead and told her to be good and not to make any trouble on the way to America. She was a beautiful child, with huge dark brown eyes and a tangle of black hair. She was wearing a Hello Kitty shirt and was carrying a SpongeBob backpack and seemed strangely uninterested in Mokhtar, the man taking her on this journey, a trip that would likely keep them together for about 26 hours, through Qatar, over the Atlantic to Philadelphia, and on to San Francisco. Dina was unfazed by the whole enterprise, leaving Yemen with Mokhtar, whom she barely knew, traveling across deserts and oceans. "You're not planning to talk to me?" he said. She looked at him, said nothing, and looked away. She said nothing all the way to Qatar. There were movies on the plane, and Mokhtar badly needed sleep. He woke up as they were landing at Qatar's Hamad International Airport. They had a 10-hour layover, so Mokhtar bought her lunch, and she ate it contentedly, and eventually Dina fell asleep on his shoulder as they waited for the flight to Philadelphia. She slept through much of that leg, and when she wasn't asleep, she ate the plastic-wrapped airline food and watched 7 hours of cartoons. When they landed in Philadelphia, Mokhtar held Dina's hand. She was so sleepy she allowed it, and they approached customs. There were two lines, one with a younger man at the booth and the other staffed by an older man. And though neither line was very long, one was faster than the other, so Mokhtar chose that one, and soon found himself greeting the younger man. Later, he wondered if this had been an error. It was an impossible game that he and many Arab Americans had been trying to play for years now. Was it the younger people in positions of authority who were more likely to be enlightened, understanding, raised in a more diverse and connected world? Or were the older ones, who had seen more of the world's travelers come through U.S. airports, more understanding? "Hi," Mokhtar said in his most American way, to show he had no accent, that he was American-raised. It made no difference. Within 2 minutes, the young official put Mokhtar's passport in a red envelope.
"Step over here," the official said. "Don't worry, you're not in trouble."
Mokhtar and Dina were led into a side room, and when the door opened, he saw a small sea of Arab faces. Strangely enough, though he'd flown plenty inside the United States and in and out of Yemen, he'd never been selected for any secondary screening, no additional interviews, nothing. The novelty, seeing this room firsthand after hearing about it for so many years, activated his sense of the absurd.
"Salaam alaikum,"
he said loudly, giving them a big semicircle wave. Some laughed. Most returned the greeting.
"Wa alaikum assalam."
Others seemed too worried or tired or numb. Some had been waiting 5 and 6 hours. This was the room where time ceased to have meaning, and some of the men and women in the room seemed far beyond their patience. He and Dina sat for a spell, until Mokhtar was approached by a soft-faced official. His name tag said his name was Joel.
"Hi, Mokhtar," he said. "Can I call you Mo?"
"No," Mokhtar said, and then he couldn't help himself. "Can I call you Joe?" Joel smiled indulgently, and Mokhtar smiled, trying to communicate that the screening process was inherently flawed and racist, but he would, for now, maintain a sense of humor. Joel seemed apologetic. He said it was just a formality, all this, as they left the room and went down a hallway to a baggage area where Mokhtar had to claim his suitcases. When Joel saw how many suitcases Mokhtar had checked, he was intrigued, but continued to smile, saying it was not a problem, that this was just a formality, a normal process. With the help of another official, the suitcases were taken to a steel table and opened, exposing all his beans and so many plastic bags. Mokhtar knew this would be far too interesting to Joel, and to customs in general. He knew he'd miss his connecting flight. He thought of lawyers he could call on the East Coast.
"So, what do you do?" Joel asked.
Trying to suppress his frustration, Mokhtar said he worked in coffee. He was an importer. He was helping to improve conditions for Yemeni farmers. And, by the way, he was doing much of this work with the cooperation of USAID, that he was helping the U.S. government.
"My government," he said, his voice rising. "I'm helping us look good over there."
Now Joel was interested, but the tone of the conversation seemed to have changed. He asked Mokhtar about coffee, about which coffees were the best. Did Mokhtar think dark roast or light roast was superior, and which was preferred by experts? Mokhtar calmed a bit and talked with as much levity as he could about varietals and different roasts and the effect of elevation on coffee fruits, the relative advantages of Yemeni coffee, how Joel should ask for it at the next cafe he went to, that soon enough Joel would be able to order coffee imported by Mokhtar himself. And because all this coffee talk seemed to be going so well, Mokhtar allowed himself to believe that he and Dina would soon be permitted to zip up all the suitcases and be on their way. But first, Joel said, there was an agricultural screening. All the suitcases were zipped up again, and they pushed them down another hallway and into another room, where they were put on steel tables again. A uniformed woman told Mokhtar he couldn't import all these green samples without documentation and permits, and he lost track of all the things she was saying, because he hadn't thought of any of this while he'd been packing the beans. He'd survived what might have been a racist interview, but now was confronted by a very legitimate question from this reasonable woman about the legality of importing 6 suitcases of green beans, which may or may not be bringing along an invasive species or unknown bacteria. The woman seemed unsure what category coffee fell into, though. It wasn't a live plant, after all. These were beans. And while they were talking, she cycled through the usual order of conversation, just as Joel had. You're from Yemen? And there's coffee in Yemen? Fertile areas? Things really grow there? I love coffee, she said. Is this good coffee? Can I get it at the grocery store? Does Starbucks sell Yemeni coffee? Incredibly, after 10 minutes with the agricultural inspector, Mokhtar was re-zipping the suitcases and was allowed to proceed. It was either the power of coffee or the power of his charm, but he was on his way, holding tight to Dina's hand, and feeling very good about all this, and feeling almost sure he would make their connecting flight. Then Joel led him to the back of the screening line. You have to go through security again. He put his carry-ons through, put Dina's SpongeBob backpack on the conveyor, thinking this was the last stage, and not so onerous, really. But after the x-rays and scanners, he and Dina were pulled aside again, and while TSA swabbed his carry-on bag for explosive dust, he turned to see Dina being frisked. They were cleared, and they walked down the hallway, looking for the connecting flight. But because they'd come through the agricultural screening, they'd ended up in a strange part of the airport, far from their gate. The TSA staff had directed him where to go, left and right and left again. But now he was lost and outside the security checkpoint again. The only way to get to the gates would be another screening. So they went through another screening. After the screening, while rushing to the gate, with a few minutes to make the flight, Mokhtar was met by a random TSA official.
Can I ask you some questions?
The questions were about Mokhtar's trip to Yemen, his work, his residence in the United States. The questions went on for 10 minutes, long enough that Mokhtar and Dina missed their flight. They'd already been at the Philadelphia airport 4 hours. The next flight was 6 hours away. Mokhtar went to the airline desk and was greeted by an African-American woman who apologized for his trouble and issued him and Dina new tickets, which had the two of them separated. Mokhtar asked for seats together, and the clerk said that was possible, but that he would have to pay extra. He paid, and she gave him his new tickets, which bore the code that indicated that they'd been singled out for extra screenings. You know what? He said. You work in a racist institution. You should know about these things. I've been through 4 hours of screenings, and I missed the flight. That's why I'm here getting a new flight, and you're putting me through another screening because I'm brown. Mokhtar was on a roll, his voice rising. People around him were listening. He went on. Are you in a union? You work for a racist organization. This is a racist system. Until the African-American agent and the white male agent next to her began apologizing, and until the white man came around and leaned down to Dina.
You want a sticker?
The man asked.
We don't want your stickers, Mokhtar said. We want dignity.
Everyone at the gate was listening. A few people clapped. He fumed until the flight boarded, and when he gave his ticket to the agent and the ticket went through the machine, another signal alerted the agent to pull him aside. She looked around and said, Just go. He took Dina's hand and flew. Chapter 24. This one's interesting. You lost weight. That was the first thing everyone at Boot said. Moktar had lost 25 pounds. You lost your ass, they noted. Moktar and Steven spent 10 hours cleaning the Yemeni samples. They were dirty, unsorted, full of broken beans and defects. Once they had something to work with, Steven carefully roasted all 21 varietals, and then Moktar and Steven and Willem held a very official cupping session to determine whether or not Moktar, and by extension, Yemen, had any hope in the world of specialty coffee. The first batches were dismal.
DOA,
said Willem about one after another. They were at Booth Coffee in Mill Valley, and Moktar was in the moment, hoping for the best with these beans, picturing the farmers he'd met, the general and Malik and Yusuf, whose hopes rose and fell on whether or not their coffee would garner a higher price, a premium price.
DOA,
Willem said about another varietal. That day, they cupped 10 varietals, and Willem's verdict for all 10 of them had been the same. Not viable. The samples were dirty, earthy, muddy, old, and over-fermented. Unclean and without merit. Moktar hadn't expected anything extraordinary. He figured if he had a few samples that scored in the 80s, he could work with that. He could bring those up to 90 over the course of seasons or years. But so far, none of his coffees had cupped over 70. Coffee this bad would not warrant going back to Yemen. There would be no point. The next day, Stephen carefully roasted the remaining 11 samples, doing all he could to increase the chances of the coffee clawing its way to respectability.
DOA, Willem said again.
5 of the last 10 had no value whatsoever. They hadn't justified the expense of bringing them back from Yemen. Moktar didn't know if there was any point in continuing. He didn't think he could hear the letters DOA again. Then, Willem made a sound, a surprised sound.
This one's interesting, he said.
A few days later, Moktar was standing outside Royal Grounds Coffee, a major regional roaster and importer based in Northern California. And he was crying. Willem, Jody, and other Q graders had scored 3 of Moktar's samples in the 90s. 2 were from Hema, 1 from Ib. 1 was Malik's. Moktar had taken the samples to Royal Grounds, and based on the scores, they said they would buy 18 tons. Moktar didn't have 18 tons of anything, but in theory, he could get it, if he could pay for it. Again, he went to Omar. He told him about the scores, about the promise of significant orders from major roasters and retailers. Omar assembled a small group of investors, all of them Arab Americans who had done well in the tech sector. Together, they arranged to loan Moktar the funds necessary, about $300,000, to buy a container's worth of coffee. There were contingencies, of course. The coffee had to be of the highest quality, and the coffee had to somehow get shipped out of a highly unstable country. And they could not release the money to Moktar until he proved the value of the coffee and proved he could get it out. Moktar agreed. He didn't know any better and had no other options. And he believed he could do it. Even though the last time he had significant amounts of cash, he'd put it in a satchel and lost it in a parking lot. His parents were proud of his work in Yemen, but didn't want him to go back. He'd returned 25 pounds lighter than when he'd left, his skin pale and his eyes sunken. The malaria and the tapeworm, whatever that had been, had wrecked his body. They worried about his health, but more so about the fact that the Houthis had overtaken Sana'a a few weeks earlier, on September 21st, and it was possible the country would devolve into civil war. But Moktar bought his ticket. The next harvest was coming soon, and now he could actually buy coffee. He had to buy coffee. His investors expected it, and he had Royal Grounds waiting for it. Now it was just a matter of finishing his Q-grading test, so he could return to Yemen as the first Arab Q-grader in history. Easy. Not easy. He took the test again. Again, it was Jody administering it, and it was just as difficult as before, but because he'd come so close before, and because, he thought, he was now in touch with the origins of coffee and was on a mission propelled by fate and God, he passed. In September of 2014, Mokhtar became the world's first Arab Q-grader of Arabica coffee, and in October, he returned to Yemen, to Hama. He wanted to visit Malik, the man he'd first seen under the coffee tree. It was his coffee that had scored the highest, that had extended the dream. Mokhtar envisioned flying to New York, and then to London, and then to Sana'a, and after driving to Hama through the valley untouched by time, he would find Malik under his tree and tell him the news that his coffee was among the best in the world. Chapter 25. A Country Without a Government. The children holding AK-47s. This was new. Mokhtar landed in Sana'a on October 27, 2014, and was confronted with the patchwork of overlapping military units, security forces, and ragtag groups of Houthi or pseudo-Houthi rebels all over the airport and the roads to the capital. How did a small group of hillbillies take over the country? Mokhtar had lived in California most of his life, and that was the corollary that came to his mind. It was as if some almost unknown militia from near the Oregon border swept down and took over Sacramento, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all without any significant resistance. One day, Yemen had been ruled by President Hadi, and the next, he was on the run. And this northern rebel group, the Houthis, who had scarcely had any real influence on Yemeni politics before, was suddenly in control. In September, the Houthis took over much of the capital. They had induced the surrender or complicity of most of the Yemeni army forces en route. Because the Yemeni army lacked top-down command, was instead controlled by its officers, few of whom were reliably loyal to Hadi, the progress of the Houthis was largely unimpeded. The Houthis bribed some commanders, and commanders loyal to Saleh eased their path. And then the capital was under their control. When Mokhtar walked through the airport, he saw the Houthis everywhere. Heavily armed but in traditional dress, with turbans, daggers, all of them strangely coexisting with the regular airport security. Mokhtar got in a taxi, and within minutes they approached a checkpoint manned by Houthi forces, or they were dressed as Houthis. But they were children, no more than 13. One looked to be 10. They motioned the taxi driver to stop, and he did. And Mokhtar watched as a bizarre game of pantomime began. The children pretended to be men and soldiers, and the driver pretended that he was not noticing or caring that the soldiers were children. The children asked the driver for his papers and his destination, and after a cursory inspection, they allowed him to pass. The remarkable thing about the Houthis was that they were polite. Mokhtar had been hearing this from friends in Yemen before he returned, and now he'd seen it at the airport and would see it again and again his first few days in the country. The Houthis spoke graciously, and in general were more professional and considerate than the usual authorities, more efficient and hospitable. The taxi was stopped at more checkpoints on the way to the city, some manned by Yemeni police, some by Houthis, and all along, Mokhtar hoped the car would not be searched, that he would not be searched. He was carrying $10,000, and was sure it would disappear if discovered. His investors had spotted him this much in cash, with the rest contingent on the conditions they agreed upon. For the time being, Mokhtar was happy not to have much paper money. Word would get around and would make him too interesting to the Houthis, or thieves. Paramount for him in his safety, and ability to do business in the tribal areas, was to remain uninteresting to all. The business he hoped to do was not so complicated. He only needed to visit the coffee-growing regions whose coffee had scored highest, and then help to ensure that their upcoming harvests, in 2 months' time, were well monitored and that the cherries were picked at their carnelian stone ripest. And then he had to buy about 18,000 kilograms of dried cherries. He would have to fill a shipping container with coffee. He had no funds to give them as a down payment, and they would be asked to forego their usual buyers in hopes that a 26-year-old from San Francisco, now he was 26, could somehow secure, from unnamed investors, hundreds of thousands of dollars at some later date. Then, he would have to get these cherries to Sana'a, where the cherries would be hulled and sorted. But first, he had to find or rent a processing plant. And then, if all else went according to plan, if he could buy the cherries, rent or buy a processing plant, and get the cherries there to process and sort them, then he had to figure out a way to ship 18 tons of coffee out of Yemen, all during a civil war and while the Houthis controlled most of the ports. Not so complicated. Mokhtar arrived at Muhammad and Kenza's house, a different man. They knew he had financial backing, at least in theory, and that he'd become a Q grader, which they knew meant a great deal in the coffee world, so they received him with a new kind of deference. He was no longer a student, and he wasn't a young man claiming to be starting a business. He was in Yemen to actually buy coffee, process it, store it, and sell it in the international market. He had returned, an important man. But he was still sleeping on the floor. There was nowhere else. With Nuruddin, Mokhtar talked about the Houthis, the fact that Sana'a was under Hadi's control one day in September, and the next it was in the hands of the Houthis, while life in Yemen had gone on more or less uninterrupted. Banks and businesses were open the day of the invasion, and open the next day, too. They talked about what effect, if any, the Houthis' advance would have on Mokhtar's work, and they concluded it would be minimal. But now he would be traveling as an American exporter, carrying large amounts of cash to rural areas controlled by tribal forces. Considerations had to be made. He and Nuruddin thought it through. He would need a driver, as usual, but this driver had to be armed. In some parts of the country, he would need another guard, and this man should have an AK-47. Mokhtar planned to carry his Sig Sauer, which he usually traveled with in Yemen anyway, and now he'd wear a few grenades. In Yemen, the grenades were more for show than anything. Men wore them on their chests, attached to vests, as a signal of their willingness to take any argument to its logical conclusion. On any trip, then, there would need to be at least 3 guns in any vehicle. And if ever they were transporting coffee, they'd need multiple trucks, each with an armed escort. The day after Mokhtar arrived in Yemen, Mokhtar and Nuruddin went to Hema. At the gas station called Abu Askar, they took the usual right and descended into the valley. At the Alamal cooperative, Mokhtar got out of the truck and greeted all the farmers he knew. There were songs and handshakes and hugs, but Mokhtar was looking for Malik, the man he'd seen under the tree. He found him in a communal house, sitting with 3 other men. Mokhtar bent down and held Malik's head in his hands and kissed him on the forehead.
"Your coffee is the best in the world," Mokhtar said.
Malik nodded. He said nothing.
"Thank you," Mokhtar said.
And given Malik's reticence, he felt the need to elaborate. He told Malik that he had brought his coffee all the way to San Francisco, that they'd cleaned it, sorted it, roasted it, and cupped it, and that it had scored as high as any Yemeni coffee ever had. Malik smiled and nodded.
"Thank you,"
Mokhtar said again, and told Malik that he would be buying all Malik's coffee from now on at a price 5 times what he'd been paid before, that Malik's way of cultivation and picking would be the model for everyone in the collective, that together they would transform the Hema Valley and eventually all the coffee of Yemen. Malik nodded and smiled. Mokhtar put his hand meaningfully on Malik's shoulder and walked away. He almost laughed. Either Malik was a preternaturally stoic and unemotional man, or he had expected this news. Maybe, for him, just a confirmation of the obvious. Mokhtar spent the day at the cooperative. He walked the farms. He talked about pruning and about the next harvest. He told the farmers about his Q-grader status. They followed him through the trees, up and down the terraces, and, buoyed by the news of Malik's coffee, news that had quickly spread throughout the cooperative, they felt that Mokhtar might actually bring change. No offense, they intimated in various ways throughout the day, but when he had first arrived in his American clothes and unable to tell a coffee plant from an olive tree, they had been skeptical. Mokhtar had never been to Ethiopia. He and everyone traveling the region had been to the Addis Ababa airport, but he'd never been beyond the city. The trip was the idea of the Small Microeconomic Promotion Service, SMEPS, an NGO with funding from the World Bank that sought to improve economic opportunities for small businesses throughout Yemen. The plan was to bring 16 small coffee farmers from Yemen to visit successful farms in Ethiopia. Maybe they could take away inspiration and best practices. Mokhtar knew Abdul Al-Ghazali, one of the directors of SMEPS, who invited him along. They flew to Addis Ababa, a brief flight over the Red Sea, on October 31st, 2015. For most of the Yemeni farmers, it was their first time out of the country.